ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, let me first confess how I am impressed by this ceremony, to which we are not used in France, because we have forgotten this magnificent tradition since 1968, and I'm very happy to share this moment with you. I feel extremely privileged and honored to come to this city, Amsterdam, to discover this society and to learn from it. And I must say that I learned already since last year many aspects of the style you have here, of living our democratic experience, the style of this society to welcome and to be open to other cultures. And because I am involved since many years in the teaching of Islamic thought, but also I am, as an Algerian who has already experienced in Algeria the intercourse between many cultures which we had before the independence, I discover with great interest the attitude Dutch people have to welcome and to be open to the discovery and to the intercourse with other cultures. I am also very privileged and happy that this chair we are inaugurating has been agreed by three faculties of the University of Amsterdam: social sciences, letters, and theology. It is extremely important that the study of Islam is disenclaved from the departments of Oriental studies. There are, of course, chairs devoted to Islamic studies in the well-known departments of Oriental studies in many European and American universities. To my knowledge, this is the first experience of a chair created to give information, scientific information, under the control of the university about a very controversial domain of knowledge, and a more controversial from the political point of view since the last 20 years, 30 years. This kind of space for communication for the societies, in European societies today, seems to me extremely important. According to my experience in many European societies, where it happens to me to lecture very often, there is a demand for such a place, for such places, for a communication addressed to people, all people, all the citizens, about issues on which citizens in democratic societies in Europe do not have the relevant information. That's why I have chosen as a subject for this address to speak about the horizons and limits of Islamic reason. It is a subject rather difficult, but I have chosen it intentionally to give an example of the kind of information we need to give today in European societies, I insist, all European societies, we need to give about Islam, not only to the students, and there are few students attending courses in the departments of Oriental Studies, as I said, but to give it on a larger scale by using all the knowledge accumulated by specialists, Islamologists as we name them, to use it to answer to issues, to deal with problems on which we speak daily, on which we hear daily in our television, in our radio, informations coming from Muslim societies where so many events each day are happening. Speaking on Islamic reason is not easy, because when I use this concept, it is not so much used up to now by my colleagues. The first objection is to say, why qualifying reason as Islamic? Reason is the same, of course, for everybody. And reason has to be considered mainly, and we are used to consider it, from a philosophical point of view. Philosophers speak about reason. So I have to make very clear that when I speak on Islamic reason, I do not claim any privilege, any philosophical or theological specificity for reason as it is used in an Islamic context. The concept of Islamic reason is a concept to be studied from a historical point of view, to know all the postulates, all the principles, all the procedures which have been used by reason, by philosophers, by theologians, by jurists, by historians, in an Islamic context. And by doing this, I want, of course, to problematize reason, which is used by Muslim theologians, but also we may say Christian theologians, Jewish theologians, which is used rather in a way which does not consider enough this historical evolution of the procedures, of the principles, to which reason is submitted in different contexts, in changing contexts. And by doing this, of course, I want not only to change the theological attitude developed by theologians in Islamic thinking, but I want to address also this kind of research and this kind of analysis of the works done by reason to the Islamic discourse as it is used today in Muslim societies. This discourse, which has occupied and is occupying such a large space, and which we know through the literature developed since the last 20 years or 30 years, as the fundamentalist views of Islam. The fundamentalist views of Islam claims precisely that Islamic reason is the model to be used to provide a true knowledge derived from the teachings of the Quran, and to derive with this knowledge rooted in the Quran a model for historical action, for historical development in contemporary societies. fundamentalist movement is presenting this attitude, referring to all the work made by Islamic reason in the history of Islamic thought, to provide an alternative to what is perceived, is refuted, is opposed as the Western reason or the Western model. Of course, the fundamentalist discourse do not use the word Western reason, but they use very often the reference to the West as a model of culture, as an intellectual model, as a scientific model, and the main position developed in this discourse is that all the sciences, all the intellectual attitudes developed in Western thinking cannot be applied, cannot be used when we study Islam. So you see how the debate is very actual, is very spread, but on a level which, of course, is lacking all what we practice as historians of thought, what we practice when we want or aim a critical approach of what reason is doing. Horizons. What do I mean by horizons of Islamic reason? I mean by this all the spaces of intellectual activities, all the trends, all the goals aimed by reason when it elaborates all the theological systems, all the legal systems, all the exegesis work done on the Quran. These horizons can be explained by referring to the Quranic discourse, which has imposed, like the biblical discourse, like the Gospels, has imposed orientations, large orientations, to which reason will be submitted after the emergence of the Quranic discourse in the beginning of 7th century. I should mention only the main orientations which are imposed by the Quranic discourse and to which reason, as it is used in Islamic context, will be bound, will be constrained. First, a vision of time. Time before the emergence of the Quran, time after the emergence of the Quran. Time is divided exactly like in Christianity. Before the event of the Quran as a divine event. And theologians will speak about the theological status of people before the event of the Quran. And they will speak about the status of people after the event of the Quran. This is the meaning of the Hijra era, which is introduced in Islamic history. So there is a perception of time, which has many consequences about the perception and the interpretation of the history before and the history after. Second, the space, the division of space. Jurists and theologians will elaborate a division of space into two spaces. The space which is for the infidels, as they are called, Darul Harb, as the jurists say, the lands where infidels are not yet converted to Islam, and in these lands, according to the conception which is elaborated by jurists and theologians, there will be wars between Muslims, believers, and the infidels who are not believers. And the space of Islam, where Islam is applied, where Islam is received, where human beings will be divided also into an hierarchy according to the definitions put in the Quran itself. There is, of course, the first class, if I may say, the first category is the category of the believers. The second category is the category of the peoples of the book, peoples who have received revelation. And the third category is are the peoples who are not yet converted to Islam, or who are not Jews and Christians. I have no time to insist on this and to show how reason in the elaboration of what we call Islamic law will be bound to the texts of the Quran, to derive from all these texts with an exegetical strategy all the laws which characterize what we call Islamic law. Here there is a very important point which we have to link to the present situation. As you know, the fundamentalist discourse insists on the necessity to reactivate in Muslim societies what we call the religious law, the Sharia. And this Sharia, as it is claimed today, is still perceived, presented as a divine law, because it is said that jurists in the medieval ages have correctly used their linguistic knowledge, their grammatical knowledge, their historical knowledge to derive from the text of the Quran all the laws. So the laws derived with this work, which is, as you see, a work based, as I said, on procedures, on definitions, on concepts which are used by reason. I have no time to elaborate it, of course, here. All this material, which is a cultural material, which is an intellectual material, which is special to the period of medieval ages, because this work has been done historically from 7th century to 4th century. 7th century to 10th century. I was thinking to 4th century in the Hijra, from the 1st century to the 4th century of the Hijra. So this period is extremely important. It is considered as the classical period in which Islamic reason has developed all its theories, all its systems. And today, when we refer to Islamic law as a divine law, of course, fundamentalists do not pay any attention to the historical contexts in which all this law has been elaborated. That's why we have so many problems today, even when we are in Amsterdam, or when we are in Paris, or when we are in Berlin, because there is something extremely important which characterizes the history of Islamic reason. It is the second part. If I have time, I'm afraid I'm giving too much time to this first part. It is the part which I have entitled The Limits of Islamic Reason. I say just one word about it, and I shall come back to it. the historical, the important central historical fact is that Islamic reason after 16th century is cut from two dimensions. The first dimension is the work done by Islamic reason in classical time from 7th century to 12th century. This will be forgotten more and more for reasons I cannot, of course, elaborate here. The second rupture between Islamic reason is between Islamic reason and all what is happening, all what happened in the evolution of European thinking since 16th century up to nowadays. This is enormous, because it's the time, as we know, of what we call in Europe modernity. Islamic reason did not participate to the elaboration of modernity during 400 years. If we accept, of course, some fragments of modernity, which will be taken during 19th century by some intellectuals when there will be a contact through colonial period, a contact between European reason as it has been evolved since 16th century and Islamic reason. This is a very important fact. And until today, when we speak about Islamic reason, there are very few people, very few of those who are holding to the necessity to reactivate Islamic law, few of them are thinking to the historical conditions in which Islamic law has been elaborated. I cannot go further, unfortunately, in this way. I would like to give another aspect of Islamic reason, which also has a great importance in the classical time. What I told up to now is more specifically the religious reason, is reason linked to the text of the Quran, is reason linked to the teachings of the Prophet. This may be described as the religious reason properly. There has been, in the same classical time, another development of reason, which I present as the humanistic reason, the humanist reason. There has been a humanist movement in many cities in the classical period, and this humanist movement is illustrated by many names who, of course, did never put aside their beliefs, put aside their reference to religious beliefs, to Islam. But nevertheless, they have developed a whole culture, especially by the development of the Greek philosophy, of the Greek sciences. All the Greek heritage, which has been translated either from Greek to Arabic or from Syriac, the Syriac language, to Arabic, and which has been used as an intellectual reference to develop a concern for the knowledge devoted to man as a problem. There is a saying, a famous saying, of Abu Hayyan al-Tawhidi, who is one of these thinkers in 10th century, who said, in a sentence, man is a problem for man. And he demonstrated in all his works and the works of his contemporaries, thinkers of his time, he demonstrated this concern for man as a problem. And when I say man as a problem, it means that the study of history, the study of geography, the study of literature, the study even of all what is linked to religion, is done according to the necessity to enlarge the knowledge about human beings. By using a constant reference to reason as a tool for knowledge, but for a criticized knowledge, which is an aspect, of course, of the humanist attitude towards knowledge. This is an important aspect. And the history of Islamic thought didn't pay enough attention to see how these two exercises of reason, the religious exercise and the what I call the humanist exercise, have been articulated, have been sometimes in a tension, in an opposition, and have developed a dynamic intellectual climate which gave to reason in Islamic context many possibilities of a critical development, and which gave the possibility for Islamic reason to follow and to share what will happen in Europe after 16th century. So here there is a big problem which is not yet considered by what we practice when we study Islamic thought, history of Islamic thought. There is a whole dimension of research which is not yet considered. It is what I call the sociology of failure and the sociology of success. To fix what I mean, I want to give you only one example. There are many. You know what has happened to the great philosopher Averroes, who is one of the greatest philosophers in medieval ages, who has illustrated precisely both sides, which I mentioned, of reason and the horizons of knowledge developed by reason in medieval ages in an Islamic context. When Averroes died in 1198, he has been totally forgotten immediately in Muslim societies. His thought has not been taken up. His books have not been studied. In the same time, the end of 12th century, the beginning of 13th century, in the same time in Europe, Christian Europe, you know what has happened. A great success of the thinking of Averroes, the intellectual attitude of Averroes. Here there is something that we have to study, as I told, in a sociological way. There are sociological reasons in Muslim societies happening in the 13th century which changed the conditions of knowledge, changed the conditions of using reason in an Islamic context. This we have to study. And under the heading, the sociology of failure, of a part of thinking. Even the works done by religious reason in the classical time, because religious reason achieved in the classical time a pluralistic approach of exegesis, a pluralistic approach of legal thinking, a pluralistic approach of theological thinking, because the context was an open context. I used to say, since I am in Amsterdam, that Baghdad in 10th century was cosmopolite as Amsterdam is today, which gives to reason many opportunities to have confrontations, to develop this specific intellectual exercise, which we know in the universities in medieval ages in Europe as well as in Islamic context, which we call the disputatio. The disputatio is a specific exercise which were known and well practiced in Islamic context as well as it has been after in in Europe. Unfortunately, I have to go faster, and I would like just to add, I have presented some principles which have influenced the reason in Islamic context in the classical time. I didn't mention other postulates which have also constrained the use of reason even in classical time, and I would like just to mention it to give you another view of what I am aiming by approaching in a historical way Islamic reason. It is to open a comparative study between Islamic reason, Christian reason, Jewish reason in the same time, of course. No anachronism. The postulates which will divide Islamic reason from Christian reason and Jewish reason, and which will give rise to a tremendous literature, which is the heresiographic literature, are the following postulates. I mention only some because I have no time. First, God has spoken for the last time to human beings through his messenger Muhammad, as he did previously through other prophets like Abraham, Moses, Jesus, the son of Mary. He's named like this in the Quran. So you see, why I call this postulate? I am not calling it a belief, just a belief. This is the belief of Muslims. All Muslims believe this. I call it postulate. Why? Because I want to problematize historically and to, historically, what has happened. Why the Quran speaks like he does here? Why he speaks on Jesus by saying he is the word of God, he is the logos of God, kalimatullah. And on the other side, yes, he says this, and it's ignored. And on the other side, he says that Jesus has not been crucified because God is out of human reach. This is a historical issue. We have first to look to this as historical issues. That's why I call them postulates, because a postulate has to be justified and not to be taken like it is and described like we do it when we present Islam. We say, this is the belief of Muslims, and we go on. I hope you see the point here of what I would like to initiate in a university like this, in a country like this, where you have many departments of theology, which we do not have in France, for the reasons you know. And then we have here a possibility to change the posture of reason as we use it today, because we too, we are using reason. We too, we are using procedures. We too, you are using postulates, to question all these postulates and to see what can we do about the theological systems as it has been built in the medieval ages by Christian reason, Jewish reason, Islamic reason. So you see where the critic of Islamic reason can lead us to generalize the approach and to create new fields of study, new fields of research. And here you see that we can introduce in the analysis of religious reason in general, because you see that we can generalize from the specific reasons developed in each religion, we can generalize and raise the question of the cognitive status of religious reason compared to what we practice, as it has been practiced, under the name of scientific reason. Of course, this has been discussed also in the medieval ages under the name of the relations between faith and reason. But what I am calling for here is totally different, because I am opening a space for the history of religious reason by using new questioning, and especially all the knowledge, all the attitudes, all the questions raised by the anthropological approach of cultures and the anthropological approach of religious reason as it has been developed in different cultural contexts. That's why I'm so happy, as I told, that this chair of Islam is sponsored, covered, protected, if I may say, by three faculties. It corresponds to this project precisely. Now, limits. I don't know if I have time, unfortunately. I have been speaking about this maybe too much. I would like just to raise a problem under three concepts which I use as concepts for historical analysis also of reason in different contexts. The concept of the thinkable and the unthinkable, and the concept of the thought and the unthought. As a historical context, we can illustrate the frontier between the unthinkable and the unthought by the following reason, the following examples. French revolutionaries arrested the King Louis XVI, put him to trial and to death in the name of people sovereignty. This event symbolized the sovereignty of human reason, conquering its independence from the divine law and sovereignty. The king in Bourbon dynasty was legitimized as the head of the state by the spiritual authority of Catholic Church. He was sacred, as we know, in Reims Cathedral. This is the first example. Second example. After the victory of Khomeini on 10th February 1979, called the Day of God, the Imam Khomeini and people, the Iranian people, wanted to arrest the Shah, to put him to trial as an unjust, illegitimate ruler. He aimed to re-establish human reason in the limits of the revealed law. What happened in Iran in 1979 is just the opposite of what happened in France in 18th century. In France, reason put aside all the system of legitimation which was articulated to the spiritual authority of the church, which represents a status of reason submitted to the revelation. This is suppressed, and the legitimacy will change totally. The unthinkable becomes thinkable after 18th century. What Khomeini wanted to do, and he did partially, was exactly the opposite: to re-establish reason in its status submitted to the revealed law, to the Quranic revealed law. We come back, as I told you, to the conception of law as it has been elaborated in the medieval age. So you see here the dialectic between the thinkable and the unthinkable in two different contexts. Another example. The Mu'tazili school is well known for its struggle to impose the theological theory of God's created speech. It is a very important attitude developed by a very important theological school in a 8th and 9th century in the history of Islam. This theory of God's created speech, which means that the Quran was considered as created in its linguistic Arabic expression, has been enforced by the Caliph in 9th century. In 11th century, another Caliph, Al-Qadir, issued a sermon which was read in all the mosques of Baghdad, telling any Muslim who would profess the theory of the created Quran will be put to death. Like this. You can kill him like the fatwa issued about Rushdie. The thinkable becomes unthinkable by a decree, which is a political decree, not a religious one. I have no time to elaborate and to explain this. It's a magnificent story which shows the historical evolution, change of the status of reason, how the thinkable becomes totally unthinkable. Now, because of this political event which took place in 11th century, all the history of Islamic reason since that time didn't pay attention to this important theological issue concerning the Quran. And it became unthinkable, unthought through time. The unthinkable becomes through time, when it is imposed through time, it becomes the unthought in the tradition of thinking. You see how important it is to understand what is happening today in the Islamic discourse, which we present as a fundamentalist discourse. I apologize. I know that it is extremely late already, and I must just add some words about the situation of Islamic reason today. When we speak in Europe and America about post-modernity, again, during the time of modernity, which means that reason in European context is going faster and faster, is creating new tools, new attitudes, new procedures. In the same time, when we consider the history of Muslim societies since the 60s, what happens? A widening gap between the use made of reason in a Muslim context, for many reasons again, which have to be studied, and what is happening in Europe. That's why you see the importance of these spaces I mentioned in the beginning, like the one we are inaugurating here in Europe, because we have to catch the opportunity in Europe of the existence of all the surrounding, the intellectual, cultural surrounding, to do things which, unfortunately, for social reasons, political reasons, economic reasons, and not for this kind of fundamentalism, which is an abstract, monstrous concept which is built by political scientists, because behind the concept of fundamentalism there are many realities which are not taken into consideration to explain why there is a widening gap instead of having, like we hoped and thought in the beginning of the 60s, just after the independence of many countries, we hoped and thought that the gap will be narrowed instead of being widened. I apologize for having maybe spoken more than I should have. I wish to end this address by thanking very warmly the Minister of Culture, who made possible the creation of this chair, which shows the political will in the government of this country to handle the issue of the immigrants on another way than the ways which we know, on which we are speaking in many European countries. I hope that this example will be followed. There is another example of this country given also since some years, which is the fact that the foreigners are allowed to participate for votes in on the municipal level. And you know that in France we cannot even speak about such things. These are important facts which touch the use of reason in a given culture and in a given society. That's why it is so important. And I wish to thank Mr. Rector, who also helped to create this chair, and all my colleagues in the faculties of letters, of social sciences, of theology. My colleague Wachtendung especially has done a lot to help for the creation of this chair. And I would like also to thank the foundation. It's a Dutch name, excuse me, I cannot tell it, but you know what I mean, who has also done a lot to open the space among Muslims living in this country to explain the meaning, the aim of such an initiative. This is a wonderful example of a work done on both sides, and you see the results which it can give. I apologize for many other people who helped and who have understood the importance of this event. For example, journalists in this country have displayed a great effort and a good curiosity to make known what we are doing, which is also a conception of information to which I give my respect and my thanks. And I thank you all for your kind attention. Thank you.